Good afternoon, everybody. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Glenn.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer.
Detmer present.
Representative McDonald. Representative McDonald. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative McDonald. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Frederick present. We do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Quorum is present. We have no minutes from the previous meeting. They will be ready for our meeting tomorrow, so we will approve two sets of minutes at tomorrow's meeting. Members, today we have House File 1670, which will be the Labor, Industry, and Bureau of Mediation Services, Finance, and Policy Omnibus Bill. I will move that House File 1670 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Today we'll start with an overview and walkthrough from our House staff of the DE3 Authors Amendment. We will start with Ms. Marta James from House Research, and then go to Ms. Helen Roberts from House Fiscal Staff. Because we do have several testifiers today, we will go through the walkthrough from staff and we will go through the testifiers and then we will go to questions. As a reminder, we will have time for questions of staff tomorrow as well. Ms. James from House Research.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So like the chair said, I will do a brief overview of the DE3 and that starts with Article 1, the appropriations. Helen is going to be going over the spreadsheet for that, so I will defer to her on the specifics of the appropriations. So Article 2 starts with the policy provisions of the bill. There are various policy provisions. These provisions come from standalone House files or from governor's recommendations, and I will point that out along the way. I will note up front that the sections do jump around a bit, so I will note them for you. And of course, if there are questions, please just let me know. So starting with Article 2, Section 1. So Article 2, Sections 1, 2, 5, 13, 14, and 22. Those represent House File 334 from Representative Frederick. And those are the Department of Labor and Industry policy provisions. Article 2, Section 3 is House File 104 from Representative Dabney. That contains the bill regarding wage deductions from credit card payments for tips. And then there's also a repealer of that bill in Section 30. Article 4 is House File 984 from Representative Lislegarde. And that relates to outside contractors and apprenticeship training. And I should clarify, the meat of that is in Section 12, which adds the new section 181.987. And then Section 4 is the compliance authority. Turning then to Section 6 and 7, as well as Section 29, that is House File 961 from Representative Eklund. Those sections create a new Law Enforcement Supervisors Unit and the related provisions related to the transition of that unit under PELRA. Article 2, Section 8 is House File 108 from Representative Knorr. and that relates to the use of credit history in employment decisions. Section 9 is House File 357 from Representative Cagle, and that includes requiring break times, paid break times for nursing and lactating employees. There's also a repealer for that bill in Section 30. Turning then to the governor's recommendations from House File 1342, which was introduced by Representative Knorr. Again, these provisions kind of jump around, so I will point them out in sequence the best I can. Those start at Article 2, Section 10 and 11. So Sections 10 and 11 are making changes to the definitions of employee and employer for the parenting leave accommodations. And then skipping to Sections 15 to 20, those sections make conforming changes to federal law for Minnesota penalties so that the state law is in line with the federal law, and then tying future fine amounts to inflation. Article 2, Section 21 comes from House File 109 from Representative Knorr, providing for automatic sprinklers in high-rise buildings. And then Sections 23 and 25 through 28, again, go back to the House File 1342 from the governor's recommendations. And at a very high level, at Section 23, that section extends the construction license fee reductions previously in place. Section 25 provides for the adoption of a statewide building energy code. And Sections 26 through 28 make changes and clarifications to the Contractor Recovery Fund. Article 2, Section 24 is from House File 682 from Representative Eklund, or the Senate File 659, and that contains continuing online education for manufactured home installers. So those are the various policy provisions in Article 2. So the remaining articles are more specific, larger policy bills that were heard in this committee or others, and I'll point those out now. So starting then with Articles 3 and 4, Article 3 is the Earn Sick and Safe Time bill from Representative Olson, House File 7. So Article 3 contains the requirements for Earn Sick and Safe Time. And Article 4 then has those enforcement and penalties for earned sick and safe time. Article 5 represents House File 39 from Representative Carlson, and that contains the emergency and retention provisions for hospitality industry employees who are laid off due to declared emergency or an ownership change. Article 6 comes from House File 41 from Representative Frazier. This is the emergency sick leave for essential employees who are unable to work or telecommute due to a COVID-19 related reason. And finally, Article 7 is House File 800 from Representative Wolgamott. This is the safe workplaces for meat and poultry processing workers, and that contains the safety requirements included in those new sections. Again, Mr. Chair and members, that is a very brief high-level overview, and I'm happy to answer questions when it's appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. James. Next is Ms. Helen Roberts, House Fiscal Staff, to go over the spreadsheet. Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to share my screen briefly. And just like we did with the veterans portion of the committee, I'm using a condensed version of the spreadsheet that's only showing the changes for the House DE and then two change columns, the change over base and the change over the governor. Additional detail has been posted on the committee website and I know has also been sent out to members and staff, but if members have questions about things like the tails or other detail, please let me know. So to begin with, we start with the Bureau of Mediation Services. There are two changes for the Bureau of Mediation Services. The first is the operating adjustment, and you will see there's actually a negative adjustment in fiscal year 2021. You'll also see this in DALI, the governor and MMB had done some administrative holdbacks when COVID first started to prepare for the economic impact to the state agencies. But then in going into 22-23, there are positive operating adjustments, and those reflect projected changes in things like insurance, compensation, rent, technology costs, et cetera.
So Ms. Roberts?
Yes?
Can I interrupt you for a second? I see Representative Polston is using a magnifying glass, and my last committee, they were able to make the spreadsheet a little bigger, so I don't know if we're able to do that, right. But if we could make it a little bit bigger, that might be a little easier for people to read. Representative Polston, your eyes are about the same age as mine, so I get it.
Is that any better?
Does that work, Representative Polston? All right, go ahead. Sorry, Ms. Roberts, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
Much better. Much
sorry
better.
Sorry about that. I have similar problems, which is why I'm doing the condensed version. So I talked about the operating adjustment. Then you'll also see on line 12 that there is the additional funding recommended. There's an operating adjustment, additional funding recommended for the Public Employees Relations Board, and that's an $870,000 increase. So the total increase over base for the Bureau of Mediation Services is $1,075,000. Moving on to Department of Labor and Industry, their first program is the Workers' Compensation Program. And you'll see currently there is some funding for the extension of the campus funding IT modernization. I will say that we've been in some discussions with the department and are looking at changing how this is reflected in the bill, possibly through an amendment. The next item is this is not a direct appropriation, the construction codes and licensing. So you won't see this actually reflected in the appropriations in the bill, but they do. There is a change to the commercial energy code improvements of $145,000 beginning in fiscal year 23. The third program is their general support program. And here you'll see that the House bill does have a difference from the governor's proposed funding in that it includes a reduction of $848,000 for the biennium, and that is from the general fund. This program also receives funding through the Workers' Compensation Fund of just $12.1 million. So the total funding for that program is $13 million from all funds. The next program is the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Program. And here's where you'll see most of the funding initiatives. The first is on line 42, the operating adjustment. Second is expanding access to pregnancy and parental leave. On line 44, the nursing and lactating mother's leave modification. And this was also reflected in House File 357, Representative Cagle's bill. So those are both $118,000 for the biennium, increase over base. Next is the earned sick and safe time enforcement. This was also in House File 7, so both a governor's rec and a House initiative. And then also in this DE, there is funding of $300,000 a year provided for earned sick and safe time grants. And so this is a difference from the governor's proposal on earned sick and safe time. Next, the funding for the rehire and retention protections in House File 39, Representative Carlson's bill, and that's $158,000. And then finally, for House File 800, Representative Wolgamout's bill for safe workplaces, meat, poultry processing, an increase of $491,000. So that total general fund change is $4.9 million for the biennium, bringing the total funding to $11.6 million from the general fund. And again, this program also receives funding from the Workforce Development Fund. So you'll see first the funding for the apprenticeship program with an operating adjustment, and that's $2.5 million on line 53. And then three other activities, the prevailing wage enforcement, the LEAP grants, and helmets to hard hats. A total of $3.5 million in funding. And again, you can see the difference column will show that this $450 for helmets to hard hats is a House initiative that was not included in the governor's funding. Next, we go to workplace safety. And this is all funded through the Workers' Compensation Fund. And there is, again, the Menosha operating adjustment on line 65. So that's a $1.8 million increase. And the final program within Department of Labor and Industry is the Workforce Development Initiatives. The first item, which you'll see as a change, is $400,000. And this is actually a transfer of funding from the Office of Higher Education to Department of Labor and Industry related to oversight and support for this grant program. And then you'll see the base funding from the Workforce Development Fund for the pipeline project and the youth skills training program. So going on to the second page, that's where you'll see the total for Department of Labor and Industry. Total all funds, direct appropriations, is on line 82, and that's $66.6 million for the biennium. The general fund piece of this is $12.9 million in direct general fund appropriations. And then finally, there's three other appropriations in the bill. The first is for the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals from the Workers' Compensation Fund. That's $4.6 million for the biennium. Minnesota Management and Budget is included for the costs that related to House File 7, earned sick and safe time. And these are just the direct costs for some printing some materials related to that program. And then we have the Attorney General having some funding for an attorney position for House File 800, the Meat and Poultry Processing and Safe Workplaces Bill. And so at the total, at the end of the spreadsheet, you'll see the total general fund direct on line 108 is $19 million. The total all funds for direct appropriations is $77.3 million. We do count revenue changes against our overall spending. So there is a gain of $311 from earned sick and safe time enforcement activities. So that nets out to on line 121, $18.7 million for the general fund. We also will bring forward those fiscal year 21 changes, the two negative operating adjustments for BMS and Dolly. And so the net for all 3 years, fiscal year 21 through fiscal year 23, on line 125, is $18.4 million from the general fund. And that concludes the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And like I said at the start, we'll hold questions till after the testifiers. First testifier I have up is Commissioner Robertson from Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Commissioner, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Rosalyn Robertson, and I am commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm very pleased to speak in support of the many provisions in the bill and appreciate the inclusion of the governor's budget recommendations for the department as they support our economic recovery, improve worker protection, and enable the As they support our economic recovery, improve worker protection, and enable the agency to better meet the needs of Minnesota, the Minnesotans we serve. The agency appreciates the inclusion of key provisions in the bill, such as extending the remaining information technology funds from prior appropriations will enable continued improvement to the department's workers' compensation modernization project, also known as Workers' Compensation Campus. The provisions support establishing a net zero goal for the Commercial Energy Code, will improve energy efficiency in commercial and large multifamily buildings. It will maintain fee reductions for licenses, building permits, and plan review services which will save the construction industry $4.5 million in fiscal years 22 and 23. We'll also increase the frequency of payouts from the Contractor Recovery Fund, and the amount of funds available will better protect homeowners who have suffered a financial loss due to licensed contractors' fraudulent, deceptive, or dishonest practices. The Labor Standards Operating Adjustment addresses increasing cost pressures and will enable the division to maintain capacity to support employers on labor law compliance and employees on their rights in the workplace. It will expand access to pregnancy and parental leave support and support children and families by ensuring more new parents can take up to 12 weeks off from work to care for a new or adoptive child without the fear of losing their jobs. It will better accommodate nursing mothers, lactating and pregnant employees in the workplace and contributes to healthy expectant and new parents and healthy babies. Requiring accrual of earned and sick time will mean Minnesotans don't have to make the difficult choice between caring for themselves or a loved one and paying their bills. Additional funding for the apprenticeship division will mean additional support for employers seeking to develop a skilled and diverse workforce. The Min OSHA operating adjustment will help ensure Minnesota OSHA can promptly address workplace safety and health concerns and prevent workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. Requiring contractors to participate in registered apprenticeship work in the construction and maintenance of oil refineries will ensure workers have access to the skills and training needed to perform the job safely. Keeping Min OSHA penalties in line with federal OSHA will ensure continued federal funding and will encourage employers to take workplace safety and health violations more seriously. Requiring provisions of the emergency paid sick leave, support healthcare providers and other essential workers who may have exhausted their accrued leave due to multiple quarantines during this pandemic. Access to emergency paid sick leave will improve economic security for these workers and positively impact public health. I also appreciate the inclusion of the agency's policy initiatives to bring Minnesota apprenticeship program into conformity with federal equal opportunity and employment provisions. It will make OSHA citation data public to improve workplace safety, will protect child labor data, and add energy and accessibility members to the Construction Code Advisory Council. Regrettably, the bill includes an $848,000 cut to the agency information technology modernization projects. This proposal was withdrawn in the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. Certainly, a cut of this magnitude will delay adoption of new systems and will negatively impact Minnesotans who interact with the agency. And I simply encourage the committee to reconsider this funding decision. Despite this one exception, this bill is overwhelmingly positive and prioritize workers and our economic recovery. We greatly appreciate the support of the chair and the committee, and I thank you for the time to testify today. I'm happy to respond to your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up, we have Rich Morgan, President, UFCW Local 9. Mr. Morgan, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Richard Morgan, president of Local 9, Austin. Good afternoon, Chairman Eklund and members of the committee. I'm here today on behalf of HF 800. I'm also on behalf of Local 663 in Minneapolis and Worthington. Combined, we represent about 6,000 packing house workers in the state. Back in 2007, Local 9, along with the Worthington Local, which has since merged with 663, the Albert Lee Local, Local 6, 1189 in St. Paul, we partnered up and introduced legislation which was passed called the Meatpacking Bill of Rights. At that time, we knew that there was room for improvement, but during the onset of COVID, the Minnesota Department of Labor used the legislation help make recommendations on how to help combat the virus in the plants across Minnesota. This prompted Local 663 and Local 9, along with the assistance from the international and countless other groups, to move for legislation for the safety and of all processing and poultry workers across the state. Excuse me. Back then, I started getting calls from others and received calls and reports that conditions in some of the processing facilities, for lack of better words, were in a bad way. Stories reminded me of the book, The Jungle. Some employers were not supplying proper PPE. Some folks had to choose to either go to work when their roommates, spouses had COVID, or stay home and not receive any pay for 2 weeks in order to keep their coworkers safe. What a choice. This is 1921, or 2021, not 1921. Simply common sense, proactive legislation. In May of 2020, Congress passed the HEROES Act, which earmarked $36 million for agriculture assistance, $5.8 million for direct payments to the poultry and pork producers to compensate for market disruptions and associated costs due to COVID-19. This meant that some farmers were paid to euthanize their animals, while the workers at the processing plants were hit hard by COVID-19. While the state decided to pay farmers for the disruption, the workers were left to fend for themselves and exposed, literally exposed to the virus. The work that the meatpacking and poultry workers do is critical. Job to provide food to families. The work that the farmers do is also critical to provide food, pandemic or not. This is not a food versus worker safety. What we're asking for is a fair playing field so that the safety of other or for the workers, safety for the workers goes hand in hand. Safe food that the farmers supply from their fields and their barns. State must do better for these workers. This should not be a party issue. It's a Minnesota workers issue. And those workers are counting on you to do the right thing. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. Remember, Minnesota workers need you to include this in the omnibus bill as this common sense legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Next up is Maria Elena Gutierrez. Ms. Gutierrez, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, my name is Maelena Gutierrez. I work in Central Minnesota with Fe Justicia. So I have a testimony because I am a community organizer in the area, and also I am taking the Fe Justicia organization. I receive all the phone calls, so it's why one of the workers give me testimonies. I had a testimony from her, and I also have other testimonies, but this one is the one from March 1st when I received this testimony. So she said, my name is Juana. I work at the Pilgrim's Pride Company in Cold Spring for a year and 4 months. thanks be to God. Since the pandemic began a year ago here in Pilgrims, there were many cases in the company. The company hid from us how many were infected of the plan. According to them, it was confidential information, and there were many irregularities. A female coworker that I accompanied to the infirmary because she felt very bad at the Pilgrim's nurse station, they told her that it was her menopause and that is why she felt those symptoms. After we started reporting to the authorities, they started cleaning, according to them, deep cleaning. But for a few months ago now, they stopped cleaning, and it's as before. The bathrooms are always dirty. We punch in out all the groups at the same time. Too many of us are pushed up against each other in order to punch in out on time. And we all go for breaks again at the same time. We all pile on top of each other to use the microwaves so we can heat our food on time. We went back to the same of all being in groups together, and now the contagious of COVID has returned to the company and nobody's paying attention to what is happening at Pilgrim's Pride. And on the line where I work, some weeks ago, I tested positive for COVID, and the next day, another worker from the same line got the contagious too. The company is telling us 10 days have passed since the day of the test. You must be present at work tomorrow. Even though I tell them I still don't feel well. I have a child at school and the school put him in quarantine. I told Pilgrim Price that I don't have babysitting. The company is not interested in the workers are in good health and they require us to return to work right away. I earn $660 a week, and Pilgrims only pay me $295 for 4 weeks, and that's what they have done for other workers who have also been sick. Another were not paid any salary during their illness. That is not fair because we work directly for Pilgrim's Pride and they do not take care of their workers. I am a single mother, and then the $295 they send me for 4 weeks is not enough to pay my expenses. I was not able to pay the rent last month and very likely not this month. I ask with all my heart that money be heard. Please include House File 800 in the labor and omnibus bill and pass this important health and safety legislation to keep workers' safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gutierrez. Next up, we have Adam Hansen, Associate Builders and Contractors of Minnesota, North Dakota. Mr. Hansen, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Adam Hansen with Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Our contractor members and the men and women they employ are part of the 75% of the construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. They build and maintain our schools, our medical facilities, restaurant and retail, multifamily housing, clean energy projects like solar and wind, and much more. Our members are concerned with and opposed to several sections of the bill, but in the interest of time, I'm only going to talk about two, but we also share the concerns that were expressed in the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce's letter that the committee has in their packet. First, we are opposed to the attempt to classify all OSHA citation data as public data. Current law and practice already make necessary MnOSHA citation information timely and readily available through federal OSHA's public website. There, anyone can search for citations listed by employer, project zip code, date range, and more. And then from there, any member of the public can see if the investigation is open or closed, the type of penalty or fine that may have been issued, as well as the union affiliation or lack thereof of the contractor at issue. The immediate publicizing of all details related to a citation could create the appearance of guilty until proven innocent for the named contractor and is not in line with what federal OSHA practice is or our neighboring states. There are many instances when a citation is issued and a contractor raises an affirmative defense or appeals the citation. When that happens and the contractor is successful in the appeal, penalties and fines may be reduced or not even levied at all. But if this section of the bill is enacted, I can envision scenarios when certain stakeholders take that detailed, publicly available information from the citation and engage in smear campaigns against contractors or employers, even if the allegations in the citation aren't formally adjudicated at that point in time, or may eventually be dropped by the department altogether after their investigation is complete. The second provision in the bill that we are opposed to is the requirement that contractors on certain private construction projects be required to have a government-registered apprenticeship program. This will have a discriminatory impact against qualified local contractors and the qualified local men and women they employ. If you're part of the 75% of Minnesota's construction workforce who aren't in a union, the odds are you're not in one of these government apprenticeship programs and therefore would be essentially prohibited right off the bat from working on projects covered under the section. Municipalities in Pennsylvania and Michigan, for example, have recently repealed their apprenticeship mandates on their public construction projects because their ordinances disproportionately kept out small and minority companies who largely don't participate in these registered programs. The same discriminatory effect will happen if this bill becomes law. Enrollment in Minnesota's registered apprenticeship programs by women and people of color, especially among the trades most affected by this section, is also remarkably low. According to state figures, women make up approximately 19% of all construction workers in the state. But for registered apprenticeship programs in construction, women make up only 7% of their enrollees. The absence of a registered apprenticeship program has nothing to do with a contractor's ability to perform work, their work product, or the ability to perform the work safely. The apprenticeship program mandate also specifies that workers simply be enrolled in a program without any level of completion required. As written, the section allows someone with zero work experience or a license to work at a covered project, but prohibits somebody who is licensed by the department in their trade with possibly decades of experience in the construction industry. Additionally, there's even an allowance in the section for up to 15% of a construction company's employees to not be enrolled or be in a part of an apprenticeship program at all. Now, if this section of the bill was truly about the health and safety of refineries in the surrounding communities, those carve-outs wouldn't be in there. The section also gives preferences for out-of-state workers over local Minnesota construction workers. I respectfully ask this committee to please reconsider and take out these provisions of the bill to promote fairness, due process, and so that all qualified Minnesota construction workers can continue working here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, you're on mute. That's because I'm playing with the mouse again here. Mary, next up is Mary Turner, RN, President, Minnesota Nurses Association. Ms. Turner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. My name is Mary C. Turner, and I'm an ICU nurse at North Memorial Hospital in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. I'm also the elected president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. I am proud to represent more than 22,000 registered nurses across Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. In Minnesota, we are 80% of all bedside hospital nurses in the state. We nurses support House File 1670, and thank you for presenting a budget that prioritizes the safety, health, and economic well-being of workers across the state, many of whom have been on the front lines of this pandemic, myself included. In particular, nurses are grateful for the inclusion of Article 6, the Essential Workers Emergency Leave Act. Its inclusion recognizes the critical work done by nurses and other essential workers during the pandemic, ensuring that they do not face additional financial hardship for caring for themselves and loved ones for COVID-related reasons. When the federal government began enacting a series of policies to ensure Americans had access to emergency COVID leave, they left out employees who work for large businesses and specifically exempted healthcare workers and first responders. Many of the workers who did not receive this federal leave are also the essential workers we as a state have called on to keep Minnesotans healthy and our economy stable. As a result, we as essential workers have been forced to use our PTO, dip into our retirement, or even go without pay in order to quarantine to keep the public safe, care for a loved one diagnosed with COVID, or a parent or a child who does not have access to in-person school or childcare. Through this pandemic, we expected to be at risk. What we didn't expect was that nurses would lose our hard-earned pay and benefits through no fault of our own. The Essential Workers Emergency Leave Act will ensure that frontline healthcare workers have the financial security to continue caring for Minnesotans. MNA is also supportive of other components of this bill. Earned safe and sick time, included in Article 4, is not only critical for workers to care for themselves and their families, but it's also a public health imperative. With roughly 800 RNs working for the state, MNA is supportive of the funding increase for the Public Employee Relations Board, which will provide additional resources for investigating unfair labor charges and complaints. And on behalf of MNA nurses in Minnesota, we appreciate this worker-focused budget and implore all committee members to support House File 1670. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Next up is Mary Krinke, Vice President of Minnesota Hospital Association. Ms. Krinke, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. MHA is very concerned with Article 6 mandating the essential workers' emergency leave, and this can also be found in House File 41. For some employers, this provision may not impose significant hardships. It does for our Minnesota hospitals. House File 41 originally only applied to those employers that were impacted by the March 18th federal Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which mandated paid leave for certain employees under certain circumstances. These were employers who were either government entities or employers with less than 500 employees. The reference to the Federal Families First federal bill was taken out of House File 41 so that it applies broadly now to all employers. There are federal tax credits to help offset some of the costs of this imposed mandate. Unfortunately, those tax credits are only for a small group of employers that would now be impacted by this much broader language. So why is this provision so bad for hospitals? I just would like to go through three quick reasons. Number one, the number of essential workers that hospitals and health systems employ is a very high percentage of our workforce. Number two, most hospitals will not qualify for the federal credits to help with the costs. The federal credits will only help the smallest and independent hospitals with less than 500 employees. Let me give you an example. Mercy Hospital in Moose Lake has less than 500 employees, but they recently became part of Essentia Health, a larger health system, so they will no longer qualify. Many of our smallest hospitals also own and operate a nursing home, an ambulance service, or a home health care agency. All of these employees collectively would have to count toward that 500 employee threshold. The federal government intended for the financial credits that it is providing to help the same employers that it did the mandate on, which were those employers with less than 500 employees under the Families First relief bill. So let me just explain. The credits are only for those hospitals or those other employers with less than 500 employees where the mandate came from. So number three, hospitals have extremely fragile financials right now. We recently did a report of our 2019 finances that had been audited. The hospital operating margin average in Minnesota is 1.4%. We had 41% of our hospitals with negative operating margins in that year. It's only gotten worse since the pandemic. Quite simply, this mandate will be unaffordable for many hospitals. In closing, if the legislature does want to recognize our hardworking healthcare workers, we would like to suggest some type of bonus pay that might be eligible for healthcare workers. The new federal bill that was passed, the American Recovery Plan, does provide money to the states, and that money to the states is eligible for what they call bonus pay for healthcare workers. So I'd like to encourage this committee and the legislature to look more at that as a possible alternative using the significant federal money that Minnesota is going to be receiving to do some type of bonus pay for healthcare workers rather than a mandate on hospitals that we simply can't afford at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke. Next up is Deborah Fitzpatrick, Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. Ms. Fitzpatrick, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, thank you, Chair Eklund, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I am the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs for Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. We would like to thank you for including several provisions that help Minnesotans work hard and support their families. Working families are the backbone of our state, and it is not only the right thing, but the smart thing to invest in policies and programs that set them, their children, and our state up for success. Today, I would like to specifically lift up the pregnancy and nursing accommodation sections of the bill, sections 9 through 11. These provisions represent a two-generation approach that creates economic growth for the state and economic stability for families. By ensuring new parents are able to continue being productive members of our economy, especially mothers that have seen the largest drops in workforce participation due to the pandemic. These important policies ensure that more pregnant and nursing people have options for staying attached to the workforce, completing a healthy pregnancy, and accessing the many health benefits associated with breastfeeding. Advancing policies that reduce barriers to breastfeeding are smart economic policy. Breastfeeding can reduce a baby's risk for many illnesses and diseases. And as any new parent knows, when babies get sick, it can have a cascading effect on a parent's ability to balance the needs of their employer and their child. While it may be obvious how these sections of the bill support working parents, it is also important to recognize how they support children and the state's future workforce. Parental job loss, economic instability, and the stress that accompanying them are adverse childhood experiences with potentially long-term impacts on life success. Based on a robust and growing body of research, the National Academies of Science find that even small increases in family income, especially during early childhood years, can have a significant impact on the lifetime trajectory of a child, improving their academic success, health, and economic outcomes. So thank you for including these important policies that support both children and working parents in your omnibus bill, helping ensure a bright future for them and the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. That's it for testifiers right now. I will let the committee know that there are people here from mediation services as well if there's any questions of them, but they did not choose to testify. So member questions, I saw Representative Raleigh had his hand up. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. My question goes to the testifier, Mary Krenke. I've got a couple questions that kind of build on top of each other. My first question is, you had mentioned the 41%. And how would you describe the other 59% and the impact that this is having?
Ms. Krenke.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, every year we do an audited financial look at the health of Minnesota hospitals. And it's audited with the Department of Health. And the last year we have numbers from is from 2019. and the median average was 1.4% operating margin, which means half are above and half are below. So we had in that year, 41% of our hospitals, or exactly 31 of our hospitals or health systems, had a negative operating margin. So obviously that is not sustainable over a long period of time. They're either getting money from their local taxpayers, or they're doing cutting back on services they're currently doing in order to right their negative operating margin.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And how was House File 41 originally drafted?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Raleigh. Originally, the bill applied to only those employers that were part of the federal mandate, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. But the federal government provided offsetting credit for those employers to help with the mandate. So what happened when that provision was deleted from the bill, it now applies broadly to all employers with essential workers, but the credit only goes to a very few. So that is why we got out of, why we are so concerned about this bill, is because there's no federal support for most of the hospitals.
Representative Raleigh.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have another question on that, to whom it would originally apply, and I appreciate you explaining the difference between the federal side and the state side. If I could ask you one last question on this, how do you feel this new language is going to impact our rural hospitals?
Ms. Greinke.
Mr. Chair and members, what's happened over the last few years, most of the rural hospitals have joined with larger systems. And so their number of employees no longer qualifies them for this credit from the federal government. We do have some remaining independent hospitals that would qualify for this credit. But the credit is tied to what they call an overall employee number. And many of our rural hospitals also operate their nursing home, the ambulance service, the home care agency. They're kind of sort of a one size fits all in a lot of our rural communities. And all of those collective number of employees have to count toward that 500 number of employees. So that's why so many of our small hospitals will not qualify for the federal help, even though they have less than 500 employees.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was the last question I had.
Thank you.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a question for you, Chair Eklund. I'm a little bit concerned. I see the bill doesn't have a companion in the Senate, so I'm just kind of wondering how this bill makes it from committee to the floor and gets into law. There must be a way. I've just never seen this happen before. Can you explain the path it takes?
Representative Poston, this bill, after we vote it out of committee tomorrow, will go to Ways and Means, and then it'll either be combined with another bill or go to the floor separately. That is up to the Ways and Means chair. At some point in time, we will have a conference committee with, I assume it's probably Senator Pratt's jobs committee. And I imagine this is going to match up with Representative Knorr's committee as well. So that's probably where the conference will be. It's not the first time that we've had vastly different House and Senate bills, and that's what conference committees are about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Representative Poston. Any other member questions? We must have had too good an Easter recess. You guys are pretty quiet today. Seeing no further questions from members, I will give it a couple more minutes here. Representative McDonald, did you have a question or?
Yes, thank you. So just a comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to express a disappointment that in the bill, there is no Republican bills. in your omnibus bill. And that is disappointing, as you can imagine, from the minority standard. Matter of fact, I don't think any of my bills got a hearing, even though I requested one, and many of my colleagues as well in the committee. So it is disappointing. I'm sure you expected that we would be not too pleased that none of our bills made it into your omnibus bill. And for that, that is really too bad and a grave disappointment. And not to mention, I don't think I can support the bill going out. There's many provisions that are overly mandated, very harmful to businesses during this last year of hard times. And as you have heard from some of the testimony, they have some grave concerns as well, that this will move Minnesota forward in a positive way and advance businesses, employers, employees for the betterment of our communities and our state. So, but that in particular, that none of our bills were in it. And obviously the Senate, being the Republican, the majority, they'll have many bills in there. So together we'll have to compromise and work together on each side to ensure that we have a good bill going forward that both houses, both legislative bodies can support. But nothing for us in here. I'm sure, Mr. Chair, you can understand our disappointment. Do you have anything to comment on that?
Well, Representative McDonald, I certainly understand your disappointment. We looked over lots of the members' requests for hearings, and it just did not seem to match up with the agenda that this committee was putting forward as from those of us in the majority. So I understand your disappointment. I also want to remind you, this is, as you well know, you've been here longer than me, this is a two-year biennium. So next year we have another go-around at this thing.
Yes, we will. And we're not done fighting yet, Mr. Chair.
And I appreciate that, Representative McDonald. And I want to tell the minority on this, I have very much appreciated all your feedback that we've gotten throughout this committee. I think we've had a very civil committee all the way through the process, and feedback is important. And as I mentioned Representative Poston earlier, that's what a conference committee is all about. I'm certain there will be a member of the minority on our conference committee going forward to discuss this bill.
That would be great. Yes, that would be important, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other member questions or comments? Well, members, since I'm not seeing any others, okay. Mr. Hulquist, I saw your face pop up. I thought it was a member waiting for a comment there. But anyway, I got surprised anyway. So seeing nothing more at this time, I will renew my motion that House File 1670 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over till tomorrow. Members, our next meeting is tomorrow, April 7th at 3 p.m. We will wrap up any final testimony, discuss and vote on amendments, and then the final bill will be voted on. Any other member comments at this time? Seeing none, we are